Good afternoon, Bay Area. Welcome to the Sights and Sounds Show with Janae Darden, where every week we tap into the Bay Area art scene and bring you rich conversations with artists. On today's show, author and filmmaker Adam Nimoy, the son of Star Trek actor Leonard Nimoy, talks about his memoir and how he and his father healed their relationship. Then, Oakland boxing legend Andre Ward on the personal battles he defeated from his youth and forgiving his father. And a touching movie by an Oakland filmmaker about a father fighting a terminal illness while trying to care for his disabled son. Today's show is about fathers and sons. That's all coming up. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Sights and Sounds Show with Janae Darden on KALW 91.7 FM. The late Star Trek actor Leonard Nimoy played one of the most iconic characters on television, Spock. The half-human, half-alien scientist came from a culture that put logic above emotion. Leonard Nimoy said he was so immersed in playing the character that sometimes he couldn't turn it off at home. This, along with other issues, led to friction in Mr. Nimoy's and his son Adam's relationship. Author and filmmaker Adam Nimoy reflects on this in his memoir, The Most Human, Reconciling with My Father, Leonard Nimoy. Adam writes about recovering from addiction, grief, divorce, and his experience as both a father and son. Adam is an alum of UC Berkeley, so there are parts of the book that take place on Cal's campus. He also looks at how his past behavior caused tensions in his relationship with his father, but eventually he and his dad were able to go from friction to forgiveness. Here's my conversation with Adam Nimoy. Take a listen. Mr. Adam Nimoy, welcome.
Hi, Janae. Thanks for having me.
I am thrilled to talk to you. I read your book in like a couple of days because it was just so moving. Thank you for sharing your story, and not just even just the things about your father, but just it was just about life. That's just how I felt, like it was just about you, just life and just trying to make it. So thank you for writing it.
Thank you for taking the time to write it.
So this year, I want to start from the beginning. This year marks the 60th anniversary of Star Trek and when it debuted. You were there from the beginning. You were a little boy and you liked television too as well. And I know you were 10, but still when you're a kid and you see something super cool, you have an idea like, oh, this is going to be great. Like when I was little, I thought Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, I knew it was going to be something big. Did you feel that way as a kid when you were watching Star Trek for the first time?
Well, yeah, I mean, we watched as a family together that first season, and I had been watching a lot of TV up to that point, so I kind of knew what was out there, you know, and what I liked, and I liked a lot of stuff. I mean, I was 10 when the show went on the air, and, you know, I'd been pretty much soaking up a lot of 60s TV at that point, and there were a lot of great shows on, Star Trek kind of really fit into that and kind of pushed the envelope a little bit. I mean, it was a very cool, out there, in color space show, a little unusual. And we all watched every Thursday night, the family would get together and watch. So it was a pretty exciting time. And it was a hit immediately. People were watching and reacting to it. So we knew that, that the show was going to do well initially. You know, they started moving it around in time slots, which is why the ratings sort of fell off. But I mean, immediately I thought it was just a great show to watch.
Wow. And so how did it feel for you to 60 years ago when you first saw your dad with those ears dressed up as an alien on television?
Well, it was a very exciting time. You know, I mean, up to that time, my dad had just been in bit roles, you know, guest starring roles in other TV shows. And I would be watching TV. He'd pop up on a bunch of episodes of things that I'd be watching because we didn't know when they were going to air these episodes. So I would see him in Get Smart and Outer Limits and, Gunsmoke and Sea Hunt. You know, he would just constantly show up. So this was a much more exciting situation because he's co-starring in a show. He'd never had a continuing role in any series before. So, you know, the family knew this was a big breakthrough for him, and You know, he had struggled for so many years. It was welcome, and I'm so grateful that I was old enough to know, you know, what was going on while it was happening.
Yeah, yeah, I can imagine that was such a spectacular moment, and an exciting moment too as well. And I saw there's pictures of you on the set, so you got to really see behind the scenes of what was going on as such a historic moment in television. And so your father is iconic, of course. He plays Spock, definitely one of the most iconic characters ever in popular culture. And much of this book, you know, we see a man who is distant, who is a distant father, at times cold to you. And I'm just thinking for you to even go in and to share this, knowing that he's so iconic and some of his fans are going to, you know, look at him maybe differently after this. How was that for you writing this, that pressure of knowing, you know, his iconic status, but also, too, that you have to be true to yourself and honor your story?
Well, I'm very careful in the book about the way I deal with the difficulties that we had with one another in our relationship, and that is that I'm honest about some of the episodes that took place, some of the problems we had. At the same time, I really honor him and what he had accomplished. I was always proud of him. Number one, I was always a fan of Star Trek and Spock. I'm also careful to point out that my dad and I had very different upbringings. My dad was, you know, a Depression era kid in Boston. I did not. I grew up in sunny Southern California under very different circumstances. Also, my dad had, you know, Russian immigrant parents. They were actually from Ukraine, my grandparents, but they considered themselves Russian. And they were very austere and distant, you know, non-demonstrative, my dad would say. So, you know, issues I had with my dad, he came by honestly. I try not to be judgmental, and I'm not pointing fingers or blame. I'm just pointing at some of the problems that we had, that I had with him growing up, and some of the substance abuse issues that we both had. And the book is a celebration of how we were able to repair our relationship.
The sweet part, too, as far as the maturity that you tapped into and that you were able to push your pride aside when you made amends with him. I had a lot of respect for you for doing that.
Thank you. Just 12-step recovery. And I got a lot of good advice from people about, you know, how to handle the situation. Otherwise, I had no idea what to do with my dad. We were at odds. You know, the relationship was a weird combination of these incredible memories and experiences that we had together, because he was so successful, and the travel and the conventions and, you know, and art shows that he put on, his photography. I mean, a lot of great experiences, but we were also, for many years, for decades, experiencing a lot of conflict with one another because we simply didn't have the tools to resolve some of the problems that we had.
Yeah. And I like, too, what you said about 12-step programs, as far as, because your father, he dealt with alcoholism and you dealt with addiction to marijuana. And I like what you said in the book about 12-step programs, as far as, like, even if you're not dealing with an addiction, the 12 steps are just good, too, for just dealing with life.
They're just tools to help people deal with some of the challenges of being on this crazy mixed up planet. You know, I mean, it's tough, you know. Relationships are complicated and tough. Dealing with my dad was tough. I had no idea until I found 12-step recovery of what to do with the guy. And it was through using the tools of recovery and making amends to him and taking responsibility for my own part in the dysfunction of our relationship. That's what enabled me to reach out to him and rebuild a relationship with him. Without that, it never would have happened.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with author and director Adam Nimoy. He is the son of the late Star Trek actor Leonard Nimoy, who played the iconic character Spock. Adam writes about his relationship with his father in his memoir, The Most Human, Reconciling with My Father, Leonard Nimoy. You know, Adam, I was so interested in your mother because your father wasn't around a lot. And so he was still in the book because you're dealing with his absence. But there's also so many other people in your life that's in the book, like your friends from the 12-step program, your ex-wife, your kids. That's why I said the book is so much about just life. I just appreciate it, not just because of your father and to see how you all overcame your struggles, but just about you just dealing with life that felt most human to me. But I was interested in your mother, Sandra. Is it Sandra Zober?
Yeah.
Okay. So she was an actress. She was very fashionable. And your dad left her after 32 years of marriage. And she would help him practice for auditions. And I thought it was interesting because she was a hypochondriac and she stayed at home a lot. And was this because after, like, was she dealing with the divorce from your father? Is that why she kind of just stayed home and stayed in bed a lot?
Yeah, I wouldn't label her a hypochondriac. I would say that she was a warm and loving mother. Yeah, she also had some, you know, difficulties at the end of her life. That's what I would say in kindness to her. You know, she was an extraordinary person, my mom, and I think very much the kind of the unsung hero of the Nimoy family saga. I mean, my mom was very much single parenting my sister and I during the formative years when we were younger. My dad was not around. My dad was working odd jobs to support the family. You know, my dad was going out on auditions, and then when Star Trek came along, he was never at home because it was just he was on the set all day, and that led right into Mission Impossible for two seasons. You know, and so I was really grateful to have my mom. I think my sister and I would have been lost without having a parent like that, you know, a loving parent. What happened was that after 32 years of marriage, she had very much compromised herself to the point of just being there for my dad and supporting him and his career and leaving behind a lot of her own interests. So then when he left her, I think and the celebrity lifestyle that they had both become accustomed to, I think it was a crushing blow for her. And it was very difficult dealing with her. Now, that's a big part of recovery. I talk about this in the book. It's not just my dad. It's my mom was also sort of my qualifier. She was very depressed. She spent a lot of time in bed, drinking coffee, eating chocolates and popping pills. And she's just very unhappy the last years of her life. My job was to figure out how to accept her for who she was and try to be helpful to her, particularly because she was so, you know, helpful to me growing up. And that's really what, you know, what that's all about. It's just a way of accepting her on her own terms and trying to be helpful to her.
I was watching Oprah on something recently, and she said, when it comes to releasing resentment, to ask yourself, do you want to be right or do you want peace? And when I heard that, I thought of your book.
Yeah. Do you want to be right or do you want to be happy? I mean, that's the way it was presented to me when it came to dealing with my dad. I mean, a lot of things happened that were unresolved, and they just remain that way. But the fact is, I wanted to have a good relationship with him, and I didn't want to be walking around with a bunch of resentments towards him. And that's why I was told to go just make an amends to him, you know, because I had a choice. I could be right about some of the things that happened that were not appropriate and very difficult for me, or I could just have some serenity and happiness in my life. And I chose the latter. And you know, and my dad did the same. Once I made an amends to my dad, he was ready himself to let go of his resentments and problems with me. And after that, we had a very close and loving relationship, probably the last 7 or 8 years of my dad's life. And we never looked back at the wreckage of our past, we like to say in AA. You know, we just didn't really go back into, you know, all that dirty laundry that was behind us. And we just sort of moved ahead.
Was writing this healing for you?
Well, yeah. I mean, it is healing when you're processing this stuff and reliving it it's a very therapeutic experience. It's a healing experience. You know, I mean, I wrote the book, you know, frankly, because I really felt that in sharing my story in 12-step meetings, you know, I'd share anonymously that I had this trouble with my dad and I used the steps of recovery and we have a good relationship now. Well, that story alone was resonating with people. A lot of people have dysfunction with a family member or a parent. I mean, that's what Al-Anon is all about. And I'm a double winner. I'm in AA and Al-Anon. Al-Anon is for people who have a family member with a drug or alcohol problem. And when I was sharing my success story of my dad in AA and Al-Anon, it was resonating with people. There were people coming up to me afterwards saying that they were going to, you know, call their parents and give it another go and try to use the tools of recovery. So I wrote the book really as a way, not just to process and not just for healing of myself, but because I wanted to share the experience with other people, hoping that they might find something that resonates with them, something they could use in helping to heal their own relationships.
Yeah, that's why I said I like the book, because it is about life. If, you know, even just taking out the celebrity factor, because you deal with so many things that people go through every day in life, and you're vulnerable. And so that's why, too, the book really resonated with me and touched me. And also, too, we won't get into this, but you talked about dating in L.A., and I used to live in L.A., so that resonated with me, too. So I was like, yeah, that's how it is. And so there's definitely moments in the book that make you smile and laugh. But it wasn't, again, it wasn't all bad between you and your dad. Toward the end of his life, as you said, you guys grew closer. He was there for you when you were dealing with some traumatic things, too, as well. And so looking at those good years with him, were there any characteristics that you saw in him as a father at that stage of your relationship that you said you want to carry with you in your own personal journey through fatherhood?
Yeah, I mean, you know, later on in life, my dad was a very different person. I mean, he had changed quite a bit himself. He has said, and we have clips of this in the Spock documentary I made, where he talked about the fact that in the beginning, it was all career. You know, family was not a priority for him. But right. But later on in his life, when his career started, when he started to retire, everything had changed, and family was a bigger priority for him than the work that he was doing, because he had more of the luxury of time, and he was, you know, had the financial security. My dad was just there. He just showed up, and he was helpful to me during some personal tragedies that I was going through at that point in my life. You know, and that's something that I try to emulate as well with, and that's a big part of recovery, is just showing up for people and being of service and just trying to be present. That is the way I deal with my own kids. You know, I mean, it's so great. Look, I didn't think I was going to be sober for 22 years. I just went into recovery to dry out from smoking too much pot, you know, for a couple of years, and then maybe go back out there and drink and use as a gentleman, as we like to say. You know, I've been modifying that plan every, you know, one day at a time for the past 20 years or so. I like being present. I love it when my kids call and I'm able to, you know, I'm just there and I'm not inebriated. So, you know, my dad was very present for me the last years. It was like we were there for each other. And that's something that I really try to emulate day to day now in my own life.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with author and director Adam Nimoy. He is the son of the late Star Trek actor Leonard Nimoy, who played the iconic character Spock. Adam writes about his relationship with his father in his memoir, The Most Human, Reconciling with My Father, Leonard Nimoy. It was something you said, too, that I thought was very powerful in the book when you talked about, you know, making peace with your dad. And your relationship kind of mirrored Spock's relationship with his father in the series. And then, you know, when you made your amends with your father, you wrote that what your father needed was to be validated in a way that neither his parents did for him nor his millions of fans. Because his parents, just to give people background, his parents didn't approve of him moving from Boston to Pasadena to study acting. And I thought that's so deep, because we look at people who are loved by millions. You know, it's not enough. There's still something there. Like, what does that say as far as like, and I'm thinking, too, in this age of social media, where sometimes it's not always about how many followers you have, right? Like, there's sometimes we need more. Does that make sense? Does that question
make
sense?
Yeah, I think that was true of my dad. My dad was very successful. My dad had millions of fans, but my dad still was missing something. And that was a validation and approval that he didn't get. You know, he talked about a lot in his biography. He didn't get it from the producers of Star Trek. They gave him a lot of, you know, a hard time because they were worried that he was going to come back and negotiate for more money because Spock was so popular. And he did, in fact, do that. He didn't get the validation from his parents. I mean, they didn't approve of him leaving Boston to go to Hollywood to become an actor. They wanted him to go to college and become a professional, a doctor or a lawyer. So there was a validation that was always sort of missing. Even when he was, you know, tremendously successful, his parents never really knew how to say that they were proud of him and that they loved him. Dad was missing something that was really, that he was craving for, And it was something that I was able to give him. And I refused to, frankly, because I thought it was the only leverage I had over him. I didn't want to apologize for my part in it. You know, he needed something from me that he couldn't get from anywhere else. And for quite a while, I thought it was my job to withhold it from him because I felt that he owed me apologies that I never received. But that missed the point entirely. This is what was pointed out to me in 12-step is you know, my friends in recovery said, give him what he wants. Just give him the apology that he wants for my part in it. What difference does it make? Who cares in the end? Give him the apology and see what happens. You know, there's no but. The word but does not appear in amends. When you make an amends to somebody, it's not like, yes, I'm sorry for doing this, but you did that. And don't you owe me an apology? It doesn't work that way. It's just about keeping your own side of the street clean. And I was told to do that specifically by my friends in recovery. I was given the direction to go to my dad and just apologize to him. And I wasn't feeling it at the beginning, but I took their advice because I trusted them. And we fake it till we make it, we say in recovery, which is you take the action and then hope that your feelings come along for the ride sometime later on. And I'm glad I did it because it was the right move. It just changed everything between my dad and myself. And as I say, once I made the amends to him, my dad was very willing. He didn't say, I'm sorry to me. You know, he didn't have to. He showed up for me in a way that made it, you could characterize it as a living amends. So, you know, the power of 12-step completely transformed our relationship. And I'm so glad that I was, you know, I had the stability to, and the you know, the wherewithal and the advice to go and just approach my dad and see if we could reconcile. And we did.
Faith is also a big theme in this book. How has your faith served you?
Well, I'm Jewish. That's a big part of my life. A big part of recovery is having a higher power. I do. My dad introduced me to Beit Teshuva. It's a residential addiction treatment center, faith-based institution. You know, a lot of it is just trying to find some sense of a higher power other than ourselves. And that's that's something I always believed in. I just didn't know how it could work for me day to day. About, you know, letting go and letting God and giving, you know, turning things over to a higher power that I have no control over. That is something I never really understood until I got into 12-step recovery. So, I mean, I've always been sort of an observant Jew. I'm a big Torah reader. I'm a big believer, frankly. That's just my own, you know, personal proclivities. But really, you know, just the spirituality of 12-step recovery is what really taught me how to take care of the business that I have control over, which is me, and it's a lifetime journey, you know, to work on myself and not try to change other people. That's a big part of what the spirituality of AA is all about to me. It's like, you know, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, everybody else. And the courage to change the things I can. Me, and that alone is a lifetime process. I'm still working on it.
So Star Trek this year turned 60. Any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, my thought about Star Trek is that it continues to resonate with people. I think it's pretty clear that it's a positive message of the future. Gene Roddenberry had a positive view of the future. That we would be able to resolve our major conflicts on this planet, of which we are steeped in at the moment. I mean, there's so much conflict going on right now. And not only that, but we figure it out, an infinite diversity and infinite combinations. I always love that. Embracing the fact that the crew of the Enterprise is, you know, multi-ethnic, multi-racial. And in the case of Spock, multi-terrestrial. Spock is the only alien on the bridge, that everybody's going to get along and work together for the common good. And not only that we're going to join up with other planets, you know, in our galaxy to form the United Federation of Planets. So the positive outlook of working together, of appreciating our differences, I mean, Kirk and Spock couldn't be more different.
Right.
Yet they found the common bond between themselves to form this incredible relationship, this incredible friendship. Star Trek will continue to resonate with people because it's a message of hope. And I think we need that more now than ever.
Well, Adam, thank you again for writing this book. thank you for sharing your story. And I'm so happy that you found some peace. So I'm happy for you.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me on. And as always, live long and prosper.
That was author and filmmaker Adam Nimoy. His memoir is The Most Human, Reconciling with My Father, Leonard Nimoy. Also check out his 2016 documentary about his father called For the Love of Spock. And you can stream it on various platforms. Coming up, boxing great Andre Ward on fatherhood, faith, and forgiveness. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Sights and Sounds Show with Janae Darden on KALW 91.7 FM. Boxing fans know Andre Ward for dominating the ring during his career. He retired with an undefeated record in 2017. The boxing great is an Olympic gold medalist and five-time world champion. But Andre Ward has been open about other battles he overcame in his life. Andre was born to a white father and black mother. His dad taught him how to box from the time he was a little boy. Both of Andre's parents struggled with drug addiction. This hit him hard while growing up in Oakland, and Andre turned to the streets. Eventually, he found his way onto a better path. Andre Ward writes about this in his memoir, Killing the Image, A Champion's Journey of Faith, Fighting, and Forgiveness. One of the things Andre and I talked about was his relationship with his parents, especially his father. This interview originally aired in 2024. Take a listen. Andre Ward, welcome.
Happy to be here.
I am happy to have you here. You recently turned 40. Happy birthday. And you have this really moving book. And part of the title of your book is Killing the Image. What image are you trying to kill with telling your story?
Well, it's not that I'm trying to kill any image. I just think by way of me telling my full story and things that people have never heard of. And, you know, in some respects, it's going to kill maybe some of the images they've had of me. Most people just see me as a boxer, see me as an athlete. And I've always advocated for being more than just that. But the struggle piece, I've touched on it, but never really in depth like I have in my book. So people really going as deep as I went in this book, it's going to change some perspectives, hopefully for the better. But essentially, it's a play on words to say who I am is real, but it's not who I've always been. And there's more to me than what you've seen.
First of all, I thank you for writing this book because I imagine that was not easy. And I can see this book, like a lot of youth would appreciate this book. I hope a lot of young people, especially maybe young people from your background or dealing with similar things that you dealt with, read it. You've been a national boxing champion since the age of 10.
Mm-hmm.
Where did you get your fighting spirit?
It was innate. You know, I was born with it, always been competitive. It also has to be cultivated throughout the years, you know, through just learning boxing and learning the mental side, the psychological side of it. And, you know, but it's hard to teach a kid how to want to hit a person back when they hit you. Some kids just don't have it in them, and that's fine. But I did. You know, I was a kid where I loved to win, and I was just very, very competitive. And if you hit me, I hit you back. And I just added the skill set of the sport to the mentality that I already had, and it made me a champion.
Did anybody ever try to fight you in middle school or high school, like knowing you were a boxer?
I had a handful of, I mean, like maybe three run-ins at school, but my reputation preceded me. And I wasn't a bully, but they knew I boxed. And, you know, I was cool with most people. But I had a few people throughout the years try me, but it's very, very, very a few. And I actually didn't like to fight, you know, because I was always afraid of what I might do to somebody. And my hands were not legally registered, like you hear a lot of people say. But if something happened, that would be a factor, is the fact that I was formally trained. And I was just always aware of that stuff as a young kid. And I also wasn't a bully. My dad, you know, never went for that. And that wasn't in my heart. He was like, look, I better never hear about you misusing this gift that you have and what you're being taught. And I better never hear about you being a bully. If anything, you come to the aid and the rescue of somebody that is being bullied. So that was always my mentality. And that just kept me out the way.
And they knew not to mess with you, too. Folks know who not to mess with. And you mentioned your father, and you write about him a lot, Frank Ward, your late father. And I understand he has struggled with addiction. And what I loved about the story about your father was that even though he struggled, he still wanted to be present in your life. What did he teach you about manhood and love?
Perseverance. He was a man of detail. He cared about how I presented myself. You know, he taught me the value of standing up, shaking somebody's hand, looking them in the eye. And that stuff doesn't seem like much when you're a kid. But I've taken those same principles into many boardrooms, many business situations, many meetings, and those types of things, along with how to treat people. My dad introduced me to my faith, my Christian faith. And the, again, though he struggled, these principles were very, very important to him. You know, my dad was also a speaker and a preacher. And, you know, when he was in Victory Outreach drug program, you know, it's a Christian-based program. Mm-hmm. You start getting yourself cleaned up. If you have a desire to want to be in ministry and preach, they can start to raise you up. And my dad was a preacher in Victory Outreach. And I have old notes that he wrote about how to speak, presentation, how to capture a crowd, all these different things. You know, that's my gift as well. And so my dad gave me a lot.
And you also write about a lot about Virgil Hunter, your godfather and your coach, and he became a father figure in your life. What did he teach you about manhood?
I mean, he was the ram in the bush. You know, when my father passed, he stepped right in and he was already playing a dual father role even while my father was alive. And he picked up the teachings that my dad taught me, and he had his own sort of spin to it and flair to it, but it was very, very much in line with what my dad was already teaching me. You know, he was, you know, trying to encourage me as a young man when I thought sagging and, you know, having my braids long and stuff like that. And this is early 2000s, and I think, you know, dreads and braids are more accepted now, but He was old school, and he was like, I don't want you to get disqualified because they're judging you based on your appearance. And I would fight him on it like, man, they gotta accept me for who I am. And he would just always teach me the reality of life and society. Like, I feel you, but that ain't how the world sees it. I don't want you to miss out on a sponsorship or a business opportunity because they're looking at you like a thug or looking at you like you don't look the part. So he was very much in line with what my dad was saying in terms of presentation about how you conduct yourself. He's like, man, you know, one of his greatest sayings was, be a man about your business and a kid about your fun. Take care of your stuff. Handle your business. A kid about your fun once your business is handled.
I feel like your book is so much about love. I really do. I feel like it's so much about love and just how people poured into you. And, you know, your parents struggle with addiction. And I know I read, you know, you turned to the streets and you sold drugs and used drugs. And, you know, I grew up in East Oakland, so... And I had loved ones that did the same when they were men, when they were struggling and they didn't have the emotional support or just the awareness of what was going on. What was going on with your heart and your spirit and your mind that made you seek the streets, I guess, for comfort or understanding?
Yeah. I think a lot of it had to do with just me looking for my place. And, you know, the boxing thing was always associated with my life. And I was burnt out. I was tired. You know, and I've been doing this since I was 9, and now I'm 16, 17, going through adolescence, starting to realize everything that I was told about my parents' addictions and why they wasn't always there and different things wasn't always true. That starts to breed bitterness and resentment. And you just, my heart, even though I was getting older, my heart was growing colder and didn't want much to do with my faith at that time. And I'm dealing with anxiety. I'm dealing with depression. Didn't know it was that at the time. And you start to, those same generational patterns are in my life now. Now, instead of me going to God or going to counseling or trying to talk through and work through my problems, I'm stuffing those things and I'm going to a quick fix. Weed, alcohol, drugs, you know, just trying to escape. And doing that and then being in the environment that I was in, it seemed like a good idea. That's the long way of saying I was searching. I was trying to figure it out. And unfortunately, at that time, that's what I chose to do.
But you turn things around and you quoted my favorite book of the Bible, which is Proverbs 18:21, death, talking about death and the life are in the power of the tongue. And you talk about how your coach Virgil would say affirming words to you. And you also emphasize the importance of how we talk to young people. When you have a youth in your life, whether it's someone you're teaching, someone you're raising, and they're going off track. And I would imagine as a parent or someone that's an adult, you know, you want to say, grab them by the shoulders and shake them, right? Like, come on, man. Yep. But how do you speak to youth when they're going off track?
It's tough, you know. Every situation is different with kids. You can't, like, I just went to the, you know, several high schools last couple of weeks and juvenile hall. And you got some of what the young people are dealing with, it is universal, right? Some of the temptations and pitfalls and different things, but some of them got really unique situations at home. And it's hard to give a blanket message to everybody. You know, sometimes You gotta roll up your sleeves and really understand what somebody's struggling with to be able to advise them as best you can. But I am aware that there's only so much that I can do when I speak. And when I speak, my goal is really not even to inspire, even though that's what's going to happen in some cases. It's really to put some faith in the air, put some faith in the room, and to try to say some things that can get these young people thinking a little bit different, believing a little bit different, create some hope where they believe in me. Maybe this isn't just all I'm going to be. Maybe I am more than the family I was born into. Maybe I can see beyond my block and my 2-3-4 mile radius in my neighborhood. Maybe juvenile hall, maybe this can be a thing of the past. I try to start there, but I always end with them looking up, because my situation did not change until I humbled myself and I looked up and had a conversation with God and began to acknowledge the wrong that I had done, begin to confess the things that I needed forgiveness for. That's when I started to come to myself. That's when I started to see my life and see my situation different. Now my ears are open and I can hear the people that God has put in my life that I've been pushing away and rejecting. Now I can make better decisions, say, you know what? I don't need to go there, man. I need to stop doing that.
We talked about your father and Virgil. These are just a few people in your life who have been instrumental in your life. One of the things in your book that made me laugh was when you first met your wife, Tiffany, and you were both teenagers. And I cracked up because you asked your brother to make sure her feet.
Facts. I didn't know everything, but I knew I wasn't finna be dating or marrying nobody with no ugly feet. I knew that. So I said, bro, you got to go check that out. Go make sure she good.
And y'all were like 15, 16. And then I laughed too, because I love that she actually writes a portrait, in this chapter. And I love that she was like, but his braids, your braids weren't fresh.
Wasn't looking too fine. She like, you worried about my feet? I'm worried about your braids. You looking like a hot mess right now. That was true. I can't deny that.
Oh, I literally laughed out loud when I read that part. And y'all felt so deep in love. What was special about her when you first met her?
Man, first it was a feeling. It was her looks, but it was just, I don't know. First it was the looks that got my attention. But then when I got around her, she just had a really dope personality. And I just felt something, And I'm trying to figure out what I'm feeling, but I just knew I loved being around her. I knew I loved talking to her. She was telling me stuff, her life story and I'm like, I ain't intimidated by none of that. Like, that's cool. Like, but you're going to be all right. And she was also very, very smart, which I really liked. And we just vibe.
That is love. And you both became teen parents. You had your first child when you were teenagers. And we often hear the story of, when men become teen fathers that they leave. And that's what I like about your book, because like it flips the script on the narrative about young Black men, young men of color from communities like where we grew up. And you eventually moved your wife to the Bay Area and you were young. You still young. But what made you stay? I mean, because that's you're a teen father. That's a lot. What made you stay and say, I'm going to hold my family down?
I think I stayed because my father stayed. That's the picture that I had. I didn't have a man in my life that ran. And you could still have that and still do the opposite, but it's harder. I seen a man struggle, but he didn't leave. So that wasn't even before I knew what I was saying, I was like, I'm not going nowhere. Like, I don't know how this is going to work out. We're going to figure it out. It never was an option. Like, I cannot imagine having offspring in the world and not be involved in their life or know what they're doing or have a line of communication. Like, I can't wrap my brain around that. And I couldn't wrap my brain around that at 16 years old. It's just not what I saw. It's not how I was raised. So it never was an option for me. And I'm also grateful that, before my dad passed, he was there. Virg rallied around us. Millie, my godmother, Virg's wife, rallied around us. My mother was getting clean and sober at that time. She rallied around us. So we had a community. We had family. My mother-in-law, Tiffany's mother, rallied around us. So we had help.
You forgave your parents, you forgave your mom. You write about people that you sued and you wrote about them so maturely that you didn't drag them. Like, I think you held people accountable who hurt you, but you still gave them dignity.
Yeah.
And a father of five, what do you want your kids to know? Or what do you want to instill in your kids about faith, fighting, and forgiveness?
I mean, I think the faith part is, and, people got their different beliefs and I respect it, but I know what changed my life and what has sustained my life. And that's a relationship with Jesus Christ. And that's me and my house. We're going to serve the Lord, And that's what I've always tried to model. And lead my children into, because I believe it's the best decision that they'll ever make in their life, to be led and guided by Jesus and allowing him to order their steps and direct their path. There's a lot going on in this world, and it don't matter how smart we are, we don't know what we're doing. We need help. We need to be led. We need to be guided. What relationship to get into, what business dealings to get into, how to manage your money, how to treat people, how to overcome your old traumas and pain. We need help. So that's number one. The fighting part is, you know, people think that fighting is just barbaric or for people who have that kind of skill set or that type of appetite, but we all got to fight in some fashion or form. Life is going to happen. And at the end of the day, all of us are going to have to lace up some gloves, right? And we're going to have to stand our ground and fight against some things in our personal life, in the world, in our families. We all got to fight. So I just try to teach my kids to fight according to the right way, first spiritually, and then teach them all the natural things that they need to learn. Hey, man, you got to notice about yourself. Hey, sometimes when this happens, you tend to do this, man. You got to resist that. You got to fight that. Hey, man, I know they coming in and they talking about you, man, but you got to resist being bitter and unforgiving. You got to forgive them. And so just these are ways that I'm teaching my kids and trying to model how we fight in this life. You can't avoid it. You're going to have to face it. And then the forgiveness piece, we all need forgiveness. Sometimes on a day-to-day basis, who are we to be endless and ones who receive forgiveness, but I'm going to withhold forgiveness over here when you step on my toes. I've learned, and I'm learning still to this day at 40 years old, the power of forgiveness, the liberty that's associated with forgiveness. And I want to keep an open line of communication with my God that I serve. And that when I come to him, God, forgive me for saying, God, forgive me for doing, he's able to do that because he knows that the same forgiveness that I'm giving, I'm willing to give it. Because when we don't forgive, it's not hurting the offender, it's hurting us. We're bound. We begin to get bitter. We begin to poison ourselves and we think we're paying the person back, but we're really hurting ourselves. And that's just no way to live. I've seen people get physically sick in their bodies and be mentally unwell because they held on to bitterness and unforgiveness. It's always better to release a person. You don't have to excuse the behavior. Look, man, what you did was wrong, bro, but I'll forgive you. Now, we may not even kick it. I can't deal with you on that level, but I forgive you, man. I'll release you. I'm not holding nothing against you. And sometimes you got to forgive more than one time, but I'm willing to commit to that process. And I'm teaching my kids that even that. Your sister, man, she said this to you. She was wrong. You got to forgive her. What does that look like? Well, you got to say, God, forgive my sister for what she did. Help me to not be bitter. I'm trying to model and teach them this because when I am gone and my wife is gone, they are going to get their toes stepped on. And I don't want them to be walking around hurt, wounded, and bleeding on people because they don't know how to let things go.
That was my 2024 interview with boxing legend Andre Ward. His book is Killing the Image, A Champion's Journey of Faith, Fighting, and Forgiveness. Next up, a film about a father battling a serious illness while trying to make his son, who is disabled, more independent. Stay with us. You're listening to the Sights and Sounds Show with me, Janae Darden, on KALW 91.7 FM. There's a concerning question some parents have when it comes to their children who are disabled. Who is going to take care of my child when I die? In the award-winning film, Paper Bag Plan, a father faces that possibility when he learns he's diagnosed with colon cancer. He's the primary caretaker for his disabled 25-year-old son who lives with cerebral palsy. He tries to make his son more independent by training him to be a bagger at a grocery store. Paper Bag Plan comes from the creative mind of Oakland filmmaker Anthony Lucero. It's inspired by his mother and disabled brother. The film is streaming on various platforms. I'm telling you, this film will touch your heart. It is so, so good. I spoke with Anthony Lucero in 2025. Here's an excerpt of that interview. Welcome, Anthony.
Hi, Janae. Thank you for having me.
So I understand Paper Bag Plan was inspired by your mother and disabled brother. What did you want to show about caretaking, when it comes to caretaking for someone who's disabled and for someone living with a disability? What did you want this movie to teach us?
It's a very difficult job. But in the case with my mom, and somebody had coined this phrase, not me, recently, that some superheroes, they don't lift cars, they lift their children. And that was the case with my mom. And she would lift Eddie, my brother, out of that bed and into the wheelchair, into her 70s. She would lift my brother Eddie out of that bed, walk down the hallway with him, into the bathroom, into the shower, and bathe him. I mean, she is just a superhero. You look at her and she had these biceps, and I just looked at my mom like she was just...
You're like, she's the Hulk.
She was the Hulk.
Right.
She really was. And thankfully, she's still with us. She came to the Grand Lake Theater and saw it the other night, which was beautiful. So I gave a nice shout out to her. But yeah, I just wanted to show that that there are these heroes out there that are caretakers, and there's a lot of them. As this film goes around, I find out that there is a huge percentage of people that are taking care of a child with a disability or a brother or sister with a disability. So it's a huge population, and it's a thankless job. But yeah, in the case of my mom, it wasn't something she loved doing. It she loved my brother Eddie. Pete passed away at 47 back mm-hmm. in 2009, somewhere around there. My mom was just, she was crushed when he passed. And because that was her companion,
right,
that's who she looked after day in, day out. They watched movies together. They just sat, talked to him yeah. all day and laughed. And it was a very beautiful relationship. So that's the other thing I wanted to show, is like how beautiful a relationship could be between, in this case, a father and a disabled son, and yeah. just like how loving that can be.
Definitely a loving relationship and a complex relationship. And I felt all of that. And caretaking, it's tough. I was helping my mother caretake for my grandmother who had dementia. And I was doing that part-time. And we didn't have to lift or anything, but towards the end, we did it a little bit. When I was watching your movie, I said, we have so much wealth in this country. Like, nobody should have to struggle like that.
Right.
We have so much wealth. Like, people should not have to struggle like that with their family members or be worried, like, if something happens to me, what's going to happen to my child? There should be enough resources.
The resources, that's something, it was in the screenplay. It was pretty deep. And in the end, I just had to cut it all out because it gets too into the weeds. And
yeah, I can understand that.
It's a film. It's a movie. You got to entertain people. So you got to pull some of that out. But the reality is, it used to be 25 when a lot of these services, people were cut off. People with disabilities were cut off from these services. Now it's 22 years old. So they literally expect people that need 24/7 care, they are just kicked out into the world, and here you go, you're an adult and you don't need these services. And it's complicated. I don't have the answer for it. And that's part of the issue. Some of these parents come up to me after the screen, and they come to me and my wife, and they said, what do I do? Where do I go? And it's a tough question for a lot of parents.
I want to talk about the movie some more, you know, as far as the characters and the actors. So the father, Oscar, is played by Lance Kinsey, who people may remember from Police Academy. And the son, Billy, is played by Cole Macy. And he's done guest starring roles on TV shows. And he's done some work in theater in Southern California. And he's a wheelchair user who lives with cerebral palsy and has a vision impairment. So he's definitely very much like the character that he plays in those respects. And so I want to play a clip. Now, this scene takes place after Oscar finds out his diagnosis, and he just loaded Billy into their van, and he's talking to Billy about being more independent.
I need you to take more initiative, to be more independent. Independent means to do things on your
own. Alone, I know.
Yes, that's right. So, the first thing you need to do is learn to make some spaghetti. It's not that hard. We'll do it together. It'll be fun.
Pop, what was your appointment for today?
Oh, nothing.
That was actors Lance Kinsey and Cole Macy. They have such great chemistry.
Yeah, they do.
And I love the scene with the spaghetti, because that's usually one of the first meals you learn as a kid anyway, right? It's how to make spaghetti.
Or pancakes, yeah.
Or pancakes, yep. Boiling an egg.
Right.
So how was it working with them?
Fantastic. I love them both, which, and it's great because some directors don't have that with their cast, but mm-hmm. these two were beautiful to work with. The funny thing, talking about the chemistry between them, when we were on set, one of the production assistants is like day two or so, she had said, "What, did you cast a real father son?" And when she said that, I was like, "Oh, okay, great. If it's working here on set, it's going to work on the screen." But those two are just magical. Lance Kinsey, both of these actors have both won awards for this film for mm-hmm. acting. But Lance Kinsey, best known from the Police Academy films, he's only done comedic roles. Mm-hmm. So this was his first dramatic role. And I had worked with Lance on a short film. Again, it was a comedy, but those moments in between the comedy, you could just see where I think he could do drama. Pretty sure. This guy's a solid actor. And he does. He knocks it out of the park. And Cole Massey, he jokes about his disabilities. He has 7 disabilities, but he's autistic and has scoliosis and cerebral palsy. But he is just thriving. And it's amazing when you look at him and he's got all these things against him, stacked up against him. But he also jokes about how there are very many things he cannot do in this life. He jokes about it.
Okay.
But what does he choose to do? One of the most competitive fields is acting.
Exactly. Yeah.
And he's excelling at it.
You know, the film is very physical. It's a very physical film as far as like lifting and wrestling with each other. And I even noticed with Cole how he uses his body and his facial expressions during his acting too as well. And I saw him in an interview and he didn't move his body like that. So the fact that the way he used his body to play this character too really impressed me.
Yeah, I feel like it's a very real film. Because mm-hmm. I think a lot of films that are out there that have actors with disabilities, some of the characters, they handle them with baby gloves. And it's weird when I see these films where one of the characters has a disability. It's as though they live in an alternate universe that's happy and they're smiling all the time. And it's like, well, no, this is reality. Right. And the reality is a lot of parents with their children, they fight. You know, it's just like any other relationship with a child.
Anthony Lucero is the writer and director of Paper Bag Plan. Stream it on various platforms. We'll have a link to the full interview on KLW.org's Sights and Sounds page. That's all the time we have for the Sights and Sounds show with Janae Darden. I hope you enjoyed it. Thank you to our show producer, Porfirio Rangel. And thank you, as always, for tuning in. We'll have another great show for you right here next Wednesday at 4 p.m. Until then, be good to yourselves and each other. Next up is the Arts Hour from the BBC.